The World Tomorrow. Ambassador College presents Garner Ted Armstrong, bringing you the plain truth about today's world news and the prophecies of the world tomorrow.
I'll bet you thought it all belonged to the ancient past. I'll bet you thought it belonged to Galileo's confession or to the Scopes trial, this thing of whether or not creationists, with the story of which came first, the chicken or the egg, or evolutionists with the story about fish crawling ashore and becoming reptiles and mammals, was long since buried in the archaic past. But oh no, it's emerged again. Believe it or not, they're still at it. And it's a brand new controversy beginning to rage not only in the state of California, but across the nation, and has gained recent worldwide notoriety. And that's the clash between creationists who are insisting that there is some alternative suggestion in younger level science textbooks in the California and therefore in other school systems, which states that there is some alternative suggestion, some alternative theory for the origin of life, the universe, the solar system, life upon the earth, than the theory of evolution. Now, each of them have their point they want to make. But first, in order to kind of draw up the lines of where it's all at, let's really realize, all of us, that we all grew up with the subtle inference in our education that evolution was indeed the truth. You did, and I did. As we went to school, we were told, however subtly or directly, of an era when cavemen dragged women by the hair into their caves, when courtship consisted of a solid whack over the head with a club, of people who lived in caves and pulled the ladders up after them at dark, who went hunting dinosaurs with stone axes. We've read the alley-oop strips sooner or later, sometime or another in our lives, about cavemen. We have the concept of quivering jellyfish in primordial soupy seas, the idea of slithering creatures who finally, ungainly, and ill-equipped or unprepared as they were, slithered ashore and left a tail drag sign there somewhere, and finally evolved. We remember the story about loosely hanging frayed scales becoming wings, about days when reptiles and dinosaurs ruled the earth. We didn't really, as we grew up, have too much of a conflict at age 4, age 5, age 6, perhaps I should say grades 4, 5, and 6 instead of those ages to make it more poignant and realistic with regard to what is taught in textbooks. We weren't really aware of a giant contradiction or a conflict between what we heard as we were told about Christian endeavor, or as we were told to memorize a certain psalm in the Bible, or we heard a scripture once in a great while referred to in a short sermon that talked about Adam and Eve, or that talk about Noah and the ark and all the animals going to the ark. It was all rather vague and obscure in our memory. But somehow, finally, as we went through life, we managed to live with both of these suggestions. We realized that religion was here and apparently here to stay in all of its forms. We realized that maybe Mama and Daddy urged us once in a while to go to church. And as we went, we heard about Christian endeavor, and we heard about the various sermons that were given in the Bible studies and the, you know, programs of the church. We went to little teas and suppers and birthday parties and once in a while a Halloween party in the basement of the church. Maybe in some cases people even played sports for the church. Whatever it was, we never did really come head-to-head with some giant controversial issue about what we were taught in textbooks and what we were taught in church. Now, as a result, millions of people have come up with some rationalization that we can easily believe in both evolution and in the Bible, or in other words, in some sort of theology, not necessarily the Bible. As a matter of fact, if you believe in both creation or belief in a God, let's put it that way, not just belief in creation, but belief in a God, a divine creature, a divine being of some sort, and evolution. And after all, isn't Dinosaur National Park for real? You bet it is. What about the La Brea tar pits? What about these giant dinosaurs and dinosaur eggs and dinosaur tracks? What about the day when reptiles ruled the world? They talk about reptiles in the air and on the land and in the sea. Is that true? You bet it is. It really happened. There were many such creatures, teeming millions, billions of them. And we have the fossil forms to prove it. And it's absolutely provable by present-day curves, by erosion, by looking at the oceans, at the ancient past, that at one time or another, there were massive upheavals, there was mountain building, there was the deposition of strata, There was the deposition of fossil life buried in that strata. All of this is true. But somehow reconciling it all between the creationist idea of a quick, divine, special creation, and at the same time admitting what our eyes tell us as we go to the museums of natural science and history, is a, let's say, a controversy that very few people have joined. They've not gotten into it. So when it does come up in the form of this latest textbook controversy, I think sometimes the general public remains just a little bit bewildered about it all and wonders about what it could mean. I'll say this, you can't believe in both the Bible and evolution. Or you can believe in some kind of a watered-down theology of your own in evolution, all you wish, but you can't believe in the Bible and evolution. The only way to say you believe in the Bible and evolution is to say you don't believe the Bible is true, that it's largely mythological, and therefore you have a household god and a religion of convenience, which is one which suits you, which feels good to you, just like trying on a suit of clothes. You have a comfortable notion about God as being a first cause, or a divine theory, or a life principle, or something of this nature, but not a creator God who is a personality who said in the beginning, God, and then God said, let there be light, and there was light. You can't believe in that and evolution at the same time. Well, the situation in California, the latest battleground of ideologies, involves science textbooks to be used in California public schools. So what are the critical issues at this time, and why the continuing controversy? In a short period of months, it gained nationwide and worldwide attention. Articles have appeared in press across the nation, wire service comments, leading scientific journals, Bioscience, Science, Nature, that's a British publication, and others. The issue centers on how accounts of the origin of the universe, the earth, life, and man, origins, are to be presented in science textbooks in public schools. Creationists want equal time for what they call the creation theory of origins. They assert that to present evolutionary speculation as fact is both unwarranted and unscientific, and leads young people to believe there is only one valid source of knowledge concerning questions of origins. The evolutionists counter that the creation theory is untestable and therefore unscientific and has no place in the classroom. Science and religion are said by some to be incompatible and by others to even be mutually exclusive. Now, the history of the California controversy goes back about 10 years when two housewives protested concerning the conflict that their children began to perceive, bring home questions, between what they were being taught from the Bible and what they were being taught in the schools about life's beginnings. So the two mothers protested to the local school board. Later, with the backing of other creationists as they began to talk it up, they petitioned the State Board of Education to require creation accounts to be included alongside the evolutionary accounts in science textbooks. When the State Board showed signs of implementing the request of creationists, many of whom are scientists, evolutionists, with the backing of other prominent citizens, organized to oppose the adoption of textbooks revised to include what is called the creation theory. It caused quite a backlash inside the scientific community. And the controversy is not entirely buried yet. And believe it or not, it is still alive. It doesn't just date back to the Scopes trial. As a matter of fact, some began to speculate that maybe a new Scopes trial was in the offing. There's been quite a backlash in the scientific community about the suggestion to insert an alternative that there could be something outside science in the area of creation. It was quite a broad, general statement that they wished to use. I think quite fair in one sense. But there was quite a backlash. As a matter of fact, the American Association for the Advancement of Science stated, and I quote, "There is no currently acceptable alternative scientific theory to explain the phenomena." And I certainly agree with that. I think anyone could. There is no currently acceptable alternative scientific theory to explain the phenomena. As a matter of fact, they went on to say the statements about creation that are part of many religions have no place in the domain of science and should not be regarded as reasonable alternatives to scientific explanations for the origin and evolution of life. The National Academy of Sciences resolution read like this: "The essential procedural foundations of science exclude appeal to supernatural causes." They always have to word it in these two-bit monstrosities so it makes the average person a little confused by the time they hear it all. "The essential procedural foundations of science exclude appeal to supernatural causes as a concept not susceptible to validation by objective criteria. Did you get that? Anyhow, that's what they said. Religion and science are, they feel, mutually exclusive. Are they really? I personally, to tell you where I stand, say no, they are not. I honestly feel the creationists aren't presenting the case correctly, that most creationists are absolutely wrong in their demands that the earth and all life upon it are virtually 6,000 years of age. I honestly feel that they have made a very grave mistake with regard to what the Bible itself says, and I feel evolutionists are also wrong, and I can prove to you, and I intend to do it in a full in-depth series that we will again get into sooner or later on this program, and we have done at least a couple of times in the past, on evolution versus creation, what is the real truth, to prove unalterably once and for all again and again and again that evolution is pure dogma, that evolution is a religion, and that it has religious adherents, that at the very basic roots and the beginnings of evolution are statements such as, in the beginning was the hydrogen atom, and that I can quote from leading evolutionists, in their own words, the admission that it is simple assertion that what did not appear to be likely, that what did not appear to be possible, did nevertheless, in fact, happen. That therefore it is simple dogma. But let's get to the point. I have here a stack of textbooks that go down to the fifth grade level, and I want to give you a few simple quotes. Now, they do a fairly creditable job, and I want to just show you where some of these subtle pressures come from. Here on page 318 of this book, that is fifth grade level, about biology, about life and its origins, it says, somehow from the simple single-celled animals came the larger many-celled animals. Scientists have an explanation, it says, as we will see later. So, in time, the seas held not only single-celled living things, but many-celled living things. Now, on the opposite page, we will see in a moment, it says the story of the ancient waters that scientists are piecing together seems to be this. In those ancient seas, single-celled animals gave rise to many-celled animals. The earliest many-celled animals were invertebrates, like jellyfish and the like. They were, the book says, jellyfish, starfish, crab, and lobster-like animals, clams, and squid. Somehow, in these ancient waters, says this fifth-grade level textbook, one kind of invertebrate gave rise to a vertebrate. From this vertebrate came the early fishes. The early fishes were the earliest vertebrates. The armored fishes gave rise to the bony fishes. Rather simply put, in this fifth grade level textbook, but yet nevertheless an amazingly, enormously difficult suggestion to even begin to get ready to remotely prove, one with which I have taken issue time and time and time again. Buried in these aeons, these multiple millions, yes, these billions of years, is the question, how could something that is made of jelly become bone? How could a fish develop lungs instead of gills? How could, in short, something like an ungainly, slithering lizard of some sort climb slowly ashore and then go back to the sea, because this is the story of the toothed whales and the dolphins, remember. It's quite a fishing story to me. The dolphins, the toothed whales, are air-breathing mammals. The only way that evolutionists can account for this is they must have begun in the sea. They must have come ashore and become mammals so they could develop the hard, bony structure, develop the different kind of metabolism, the different method of breathing, of burying their young alive and suckling the young and the like. Then they didn't like it ashore or something, so they went back to the sea, and so they claim that dolphins managed, after they became four-footed mammals of some sort, breathing out of their nose, they managed to move their nose from between their eyes clear up to the back of their head. They managed to completely change all of their skeletal system, their circulatory and digestive system, their entire system for everything. It's an incredible story. And here in the fifth grade begins that subtle inference. Now, the textbooks are doing the best job they know how to present what they feel is the marvel of scientific research and knowledge in as simple a manner as possible to children of that age level. But in this book, there is no alternative given. There is only the evolutionary framework. No alternative. Now, this is fourth grade, and it's quite simpler than the one I just gave you. It's under the section Think, but I'm interested in some of the projects they urge the young students to do, because even science couldn't possibly fulfill some of these projects. It says here, and there's a subtle hint, many people feel that life is always changing and nothing remains exactly the same. Why do they feel this way, says this fourth grade level textbook? Select one animal or plant and imagine what would happen to it if it never changed but everything else did. Make up a story about the idea that one thing on earth never changed. And the teacher is supposed to help in this. Now, interesting projects. Quote, find out why many unusual and rare animals are now found only on islands. Well, not even evolutionists have really found that out yet, though they're still trying. Find out in what ways reptiles are better suited for life on land than amphibians. Find out some reasons for the disappearance of dinosaurs. Find out the differences between reptile eggs and fish or frog eggs. Explain the differences. This for children in the fourth grade. So no matter how it is taught, there is the continual subtle inference. I call it a kind of an anti-supernaturalistic bias, not a matter of intent, not a matter necessarily of deliberate, pre-programmed, carefully thought out attacks against creationists at all, but merely the best job the textbook writers and the textbook publishers know how to do in the light of information available to them, and because there's been no concerted effort on the part of the public to see to it that there is any suitable alternative that is presented at that age, why the subtle inference continues to grow. Now, this is called Today's Basic Science, a teacher edition. This is the fifth grade book, again, a different one. But, again, it begins to show the subtle inference of evolution very early in a child's experience with education. On the section on Earth in Review, it says, many scientists now agree that the sun and the planets probably evolved from a mass of dust and gas in space. That's all it says. So the Big Bang Theory, the various nebula hypothesis, the expanding universe, the one of the oscillating universe, all of these are not necessarily covered at this age level, but they do state that scientists agree that it probably evolved. A little later it says, this history is largely told through the development of life. Life probably first appeared about 2 billion years ago. But man has been around for only a short time, no more than 1 million years, in fact. So, this statement I can see why, if someone were going to Christian Endeavor and a minister happened to talk as though he did believe in Adam and Eve, which is becoming increasingly rare these days, you have to admit that. The kid is going to be a little bit confused as to how that could happen, how this preacher can believe in Adam and Eve when my teacher and the people that write the science textbooks obviously do not, because they would say that Adam and Eve were only about 6,000 years old, where life, as we see it gradually evolving, as they claim, has been on the earth for millions and millions of years, and man himself, about 1 million years. You know, in your own experience then, that you, as you grew up, were subjected to certain teaching, certain education, which resulted to this day, no matter what your religious upbringing. Many people, of course, completely irreligious. Others religious, but only to a degree. Others with a personal religious philosophy or a kind of an adaptation of fatalism. But some who are fundamentalists, who do believe in a special creation, have had difficulty reconciling what they were always taught in school. And I think sometimes they played little games in their minds by just avoiding the museums of natural history, avoiding the story of dinosaurs, avoiding the story of evolution, and instead of looking into it with the tools of science on the one hand and the biblical account on the other and giving it a fair shake, giving it an objective research, they simply do the same thing, I think, in reverse that some of the religious types may have done back during the day of Galileo and that some of the evolutionary types are doing today. Now the shoe is on the other foot. Back during the day of Galileo, it was the religionists in charge. And they forced Galileo to say that he did not believe that the earth was revolving around the sun and that the earth was indeed the center of the universe. And so they forced him, under threat of whatever consequences, to go against what he thought scientifically was true. Now, scientists today feel that if they allow this insertion of this creation statement, they would be reverting back to giving the creationists an undue wedge or leverage to where science might once again be impeded by religious dogma. So the shoe is on the opposite foot today, and now it is the evolutionists and scientists who are trying to enforce their views upon the religionists. this is the way the creationists or the religionists feel about it. Maybe they're right. Who knows? At any rate, the controversy rages, and it's not over yet. The textbook controversy is interesting to me because of the manner in which the decision was made. Now, whether the decision is final or not remains to be seen, but I want to get into that in a moment. First, though, the urging of the scientific community was that we urge that textbooks of the sciences utilized in public schools of the nation be limited to the exposition of scientific matter. They have a case in point. They feel that books on science should deal only with science and should not include anything at all on religion. The point being that, of course, no religion is taught in most public schools unless it is a parochial school of some sort or a private school where it might be taught. The Academic Senate of the University of California resolution went as follows. We believe that a description of special creation as a scientific theory is a gross misunderstanding of scientific inquiry. The State Curriculum Commission offered the following compromise. They said that they would leave out the mention of God or Genesis, but would make the presentation of evolutionary theory much less dogmatic. So, the statement, life began in the seas, would be changed to read, most scientists believe life may have begun in the seas. And, quote, the probability that life began in shallow water would read, life may have begun in shallow water. I feel that this would be pleasing to evolutionists, but it isn't. Now, I feel that way because, as I say, I think a lot of times the pressures are rather subtle, and the children at age 10, 11, and 12, don't really need to understand and wouldn't take issue with the difference between the statement, life began in the seas, and that most scientists believe life may have begun in the seas. Because the minute you say scientists and scientific and theory may safely assume and most believe and so on, that's lost on a 12-year-old, an 11 or a 10-year-old most times in a scientific classroom. Most of them just barely getting what is being said anyhow. And you may as well have hit them over the head with a club to make them believe it. So I'm not quite sure about that part of it, but believe it or not, evolutionists aren't really happy with that. Even that pleased some of the creationists. So to date, the State Board has killed the move to place the creation theory in science textbooks. From Sacramento, the following article appeared in a Southland newspaper in California. A new move to put the religious creation theory in state science textbooks was killed recently by the California Board of Education, placing the board squarely on record against such a course for the first time. The 6-3 vote against inserting the theory of divine or special creation in portions of science books dealing with the origin of life apparently disposes of the hotly debated issue. But what was interesting to me as I looked into how this was voted was that the board's position had been clarified by this action, which had been left muddled by a vote on a similar proposal at a December 14, 1972 meeting. On that date, a move to insert the creation theory as a counterbalance to evolutionary theories failed. But the vote was actually 5-3 in favor of the motion. It failed because 6 votes on the 10-member board would be needed to take action. It missed passing by the fluke of 1 vote, or it may have gotten through. 1 member was absent, who later voted for the creationist insertions, and there was 1 vacancy on the board at that time. Now, what was interesting is that by the time that vacancy was filled and the board came back to meet the second time, 1 member, Mrs. Verla Krotz, said that she had misunderstood the December motion and had mistakenly voted for inclusion of the creation theory. But later, when she understood the proposition better, she voted the other way. Dr. David Hubbard, who is president of Fuller Theological Seminary of Pasadena, also switched his vote the second time around, having voted first on the December 14th meeting for inclusion of the creation alternative, and then later he voted against it. He gave no reason why he had changed his vote. Next time, I'll show you how that happened. The champion of the creation theory, Dr. John Ford, who had voted originally for it, was absent on the second time around when the board stood solidly against it. Well, that is interesting. There are 2 basic conflicting stories on that, and it's something that most people have never remotely informed themselves about one way or the other. So in our educational extension program, and I actually feel, don't misunderstand what I'm about to say, but I think the gospel is education. simply because the gospel has to do also with who we are, what we are, why we're on the earth, and where we're going. And can we be said to be truly educated if we ourselves don't even know what we are? I don't think so. Well, you ought to write for this brochure. It gives you a kind of a gentle introduction to the story, anyhow. Some fishy stories about an unproved theory. And that infers the evolutionary theory. Now, this brochure, along with others like it, that I'll show you a little bit later on, like A Whale of a Tale, a story about the toothed dolphins and toothed whales, goes right into the nitty-gritty of some of the things I mentioned about fish slithering ashore and becoming mammals. If that happened, how did it? And can you wade back in history and find out by real, rational objectivity? They ask kids to do it in scientific textbooks in grade 4. Why not you as an adult? And also write for the booklet, Seven Proofs God Exists, and the one entitled, Does God Exist? This goes into more of the intelligence versus non-intelligent idea of where did life come from, of how there is a supreme intelligence, that unintelligence and absolute ignorance does not produce intelligence, that randomness and haphazard chaos does not produce order. Man's intelligence is compared versus God's. You look all around you at the miracles, it seems, that man has wrought. The space age, technology, science, the fabulous day in which we live of jet travel and of space travel even. And then yet, on the other hand, you take a look at the common cold and the flus, all the diseases and aches and pains that plague us, arthritis and multiple sclerosis and muscular dystrophy and cancer of the lung and of the throat and cancer of the lips and cancer of the skin, leukemia, heart disease, all the killers of human beings. On the one hand, we seem to be able to send men to the moon, and on the other hand, we can't relieve the aches and the pains of human beings here below. Man has a great mind. I mean man collectively. I mean man in all of his history. But man still doesn't know how to deal with some of the problems that are brought upon him by breaking of what seems to be natural laws. We still don't know how to get rid of the penalties that come upon us by breaking of laws. The whole question of whether or not God exists revolves around man's mind, man's ingenuity, man's creativity, and whether or not we are in some ways truly limited. You need to write for the booklet, Does God Exist?, and the one entitled, Seven Proofs God Exists. We'll send them both to you, or either one. Well, there are seven proofs God exists. Now, this booklet that we'll send you by return mail free of charge shows you these are not guesses, but factual proofs. It's not a weighty booklet. It's a very short, very brief booklet that I imagine you can read in less than 20 minutes. It's just that simple. Actually, I feel like apologizing for that because we've been trying to get a book, a really good, thick, heavy book on the subject of seven proofs God exists for a very long time. And that book is in process of publication. It's going to be some time yet because when it comes out, we want it to be absolutely thorough. So don't write for the book yet, but get the booklet in the meantime. It gives you every one of these proofs that I've been mentioning on a series of programs. Seven proofs God exists. I've done this time and again in past years on the radio. I've done it in more than 24, maybe closer to 30 telecasts and radio programs recently, going through every single one of these seven proofs God exists. If you're discussing religion, which oftentimes is not too good an idea, religion isn't always a very exciting subject over dinner, is it? Because it tends to get into arguments and people get a little touchy about religion. But if you want some ammunition, you're discussing whether or not there is a God with a person who is mildly skeptic or really does doubt it, an atheist or a friend of yours that just can't see the proof, you write for this booklet for further research and discussion on your own part. All seven of them, one after another, very tangible, easy to read, simple to understand. And it's free of charge. There is no price whatsoever. If you ask for the booklets on Does God Exist, we'll send them both to you. Seven Proofs God Exists and the one Does God Exist. If you write to Herbert W. Armstrong, Box 111, Pasadena, California. That's Herbert W. Armstrong, Box 111, Pasadena, California. Next time, another program in a series on the California textbook controversy. Until then, Garner Ted Armstrong, goodbye, friends.
You have heard The World Tomorrow. Send your request with the call letters of this radio station to Herbert W. Armstrong, Post Office Box 111, Pasadena, California.
Tune in again tomorrow evening at 11 o'clock for The World Tomorrow, presented by Ambassador College, with three locations: Pasadena, California, St. Albans, Hertfordshire, England, and Gladewater, Texas. The World Tomorrow is heard at 11 o'clock each day of the week at the 97.3 spot on your dial, WISN-FM. The World Tomorrow came to you transcribed from WISN-FM, Milwaukee.